Okay. I'd rather have plenty of light so I can see people. Whoa. I'll only use a microphone if I need to. So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
The people back there can't hear me, so they're not saying anything. Yeah. Great. Yes, it is great being here. And it is my daughter's due date, but what am I going to do? I'll just get in the way anyway. Plus, they're in Los Alamos, New Mexico, so I'm here hanging out with some good friends in Santa Barbara. Yeah, what he didn't tell you is the story about my little adventure going up the hill over here. Kate was getting ready for finals and writing papers, so I spent a couple days helping her write all her papers, and she's reading a book. So I said, I'm going to go for a run. So there's this hill up above where these guys live, and I thought, that looks like a park up there. I don't know. I'm going to run up that hill. It's like, really steep. So I'm running up that hill, and it kept getting steeper and steeper, and the brush is thicker and thicker, and I could barely get through it. I was getting slashed and bleeding from 15 different places. And I finally get up there, and I'm like, oh, no, this is some kind of a mansion or something. I've never seen anything like it. It turned out it was what's his name?
Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, broke into Sylvester Stallone's mansion there. Yeah, and the thing is, he had like a 10-foot high wall all the way around, except the place where I came, because nobody would ever come up that hill. There's no way. So I'm bleeding from multiple places all over. Then I have to go up over the fence, and there's the barbed wire, and I still have the scar from it. And then when I fell down the other side, then I really cut this leg open. Then I had to run about 5-6 more miles, and everybody's looking at me. They're just, because I'm covered with mud and blood and everything. It was awesome. It's awesome. Anyway, so I was asked to do a talk about God and science. So that's what I'm going to do. Let me give a little bit of my background. I grew up in a sort of a traditional denomination. I went to church, and I was like the president of the church youth group, and the guy who kind of walked around carrying the cross and stuff like that. But I had one problem. I didn't believe in God. I was an atheist. And I guess it didn't matter at that time, I guess, being the head of the church youth group and being an atheist. So I went off to college, and I was pretty proud to be an atheist. I remember taking a philosophy course as a freshman, and we're studying about Nietzsche. Nietzsche said God is dead. I was like, yeah, that's pretty awesome. I was pretty happy about that. And of course, Nietzsche's dead now. God seems to be keeping it up pretty well. But so anyway, it was in studying science that I came to believe in God. But I wasn't assuming Christianity at all, really. For me, I didn't know what kind of God, so I was investing all kinds of religion. But eventually, then, I ended up at the University of Colorado. There, I came across Christianity, and I became a Christian about 38, 39 years ago. So what I'm going to do tonight, really, there's two parts of my talk. First part is why I, as a scientist, say belief in God is the only reasonable perspective to take on reality. And then the second part, I'll talk about how science and the Bible are related. Okay? So I'm going to present two possible perspectives on science as it relates to the existence of God. First perspective will be represented by Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley was friends with Charles Darwin. He was known as Darwin's bulldog. He invented the word agnostic. He said, "We're as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth or the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened, and man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." So according to this view, it's just an accident. There's no purpose. We just happened. Just, the ebb and flow of tides. Next thing you know, life just sort of appears, and then humans appear, and then we're here. That's one view. This is also expressed by Richard Dawkins. You've probably heard of Richard Dawkins. He's still around. He's there at Oxford University there. And he said, "In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. There you won't find any rhyme or reason, no justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, it just is, and we dance to its music. No purpose, no design, just random stuff. We just sort of happen to exist. Well, one thing for sure is it's a depressing thought, but maybe it's true. All right, maybe the atheist is right, and everything just exists as a sheer, utter accident with no purpose, no design behind it at all. Okay, another option that's worth considering is the idea of design. Now, I want to borrow somebody's cell phone. I need to borrow a cell phone. All right, but you got to help me out here, okay? Thank you. All right, thank you. Now, this is the watchmaker argument, except a more modern version of the watchmaker argument, okay? So let's imagine you're walking on the street, and you see a cell phone, and you're thinking, oh, how'd that thing get there? I don't know, there's some plastic, some, you know, metal, and, you know, and some other elements and stuff, and, you know, somebody stepped on it, and, you know, car went over it, and it rained, and, you know, time, and cell phone. Would anybody believe that? In fact, would you have to be maybe crazy to believe that?
Yeah.
Well, I've got a question. Which has more design? Which has more moving parts? Which has more intricate machinery? The simplest living thing or a cell phone? The answer is the simplest living thing is a nano machine of unimaginable complexity. And there's people that believe that it happened just by accident. Just one molecule bumped into another molecule, next thing you know, out pops life. And I would argue that that doesn't make a lot of sense. So accident or design? In fact, I would say a better analogy than the, than thank you for your cell phone, but please keep it turned off. You know, I used to, when students, their cell phone would go off in class, I used to like, I'd kind of stop class and do this, you know. And then one time I was doing that, and it was my cell phone. So my students get grace now, all right? Last weekend we did a conference on grace in San Diego, so all the more, you know, my students get grace. But anyway, so I think a better analogy to life happening just by accident would be, let's imagine you have a junkyard. And, you know, there's wood and plastic and glass and dirt, and a tornado rips through there, and out comes a 747. You know, seriously, could that happen? I don't think so. So what I'm going to do is I'm a chemistry professor. I also teach physics. So I'm just going to use examples simply from the things I teach my introductory science students that tell me there has to be a God. All right. So I'm going to start with a little bit of chemistry here. Now, hopefully, given the H, the O, and the H, you don't need this label. Hopefully, can I assume that? I don't know. I need a little participation from the audience here, okay? H-O-H, you probably knew that was water. Now, you could teach an entire one-semester course explaining all the properties that water has that no other compound has. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. Design or accident? That's the question I would ask. For example, water is bent. Now, I was teaching about hydrogen bonding just last week in my chemistry class, and I showed them a graph, and basically, if water was not bent, it would boil around minus 100 degrees centigrade. All right? And if water boiled at minus 100 degrees centigrade, we'd all be vaporized instantaneously. Now, life requires a solvent, a liquid. Life cannot be based on a gas or on a solid. It has to be a liquid. And that liquid has to have the ability to dissolve a wide range of different substances. And it just so happens, of all the substances in the universe, water dissolves a wider range of substances than any other. Also, in order for life to exist, life could only exist, scientists would tell you, between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Outside of that range, it could not exist. And water is liquid across almost that entire range, but lucky for us, not across that entire range. And I'll explain that in a little bit. Another thing about water is it has a high specific heat. In other words, water absorbs a lot of heat. In fact, water absorbs more than twice as much heat as any other substance in the universe. All right, so why is that important? Now notice, the same substance that has the right boiling point is the same substance that has the right solvent properties, also just so happens to be the substance that absorbs the most heat. Now would you rather live here or in Palm Springs? Why? Because you're near the water. Because it turns out, if water was like any other substance, the temperature in the earth would go up and down by 200 degrees centigrade in any given year, and no life. Now, I used to live in Wisconsin. And the people in Wisconsin, they're pretty amazing. They make a lot of cheese. They have an excellent football team. But they also walk on water. In the winter. All right, they got it. Yeah. All right. Now, water has a property that no other substance has, which is that the solid floats on the liquid. You go, right, ice floats. You know how many other compounds had that property? Zero. So why is that important? Because otherwise, in the winter, the colder ice would sink and lakes would freeze all the way to the bottom. All right, fine. But during ice ages, the oceans would have frozen to the bottom and all life would have been wiped out on the earth. I could talk about water's viscosity, its thermal expansion constant, and many other properties. And I say water is incredibly, amazingly designed by God. Let's talk about the periodic chart. Now, hopefully, all of you feel very comfortable with this chart. Some of you may find this to give you, PTSD or something like that. Now, I teach chemistry, and I tell my students in my physical science class, we were just doing this just yesterday in class, actually, and I tell them that Mendeleev discovered this chart. Mendeleev created this chart, but it's actually not true. Guess who invented this chart? God invented this chart. His fingerprints are all over it. There are at least 22 elements that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. Now, some people would say, just an accident. You know, a singularly beneficial series of accidents. I say, well, that's quite a series of accidents. Whoa. There are several examples. All right, let me see. Do we have anybody who knows a little chemistry? All right, which element am I going to do first that has amazing properties, unique to it? Carbon, thank you. Is that, are you the one who said carbon? All right, very good. Carbon. All right. Now, I teach organic chemistry, and when I teach organic chemistry, the first week, I spend the entire week telling the students all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. Now, my students figure out after a while that I'm a believer, you know. I don't, like, preach to them and say, if you come to church, you get extra credit. But after a while, you know, especially when I teach biochemistry, I'll throw something out there and I just kind of like, you know, you know what I'm saying? Don't really have to say anything. So let's talk about some of those properties of carbon. For example, carbon forms four bonds. Now, actually, it's not the only element that forms four bonds. Also, silicon does, carbon and silicon. But the problem with silicon is if you put two silicon atoms together in the same molecule, it explodes. Doesn't work very well. All right, and now why is it important to have four bonds? The reason it's important is unless you have four bonds, you don't have three-dimensional molecules. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, then you don't have a three-dimensional living thing. Another property of carbon is it's the only element that forms large, stable molecules with rings and chains and double bonds and triple bonds and all these other things. So carbon is uniquely suited. In fact, there's no other element that could even begin to even imaginably possibly have life based on it. All right. Another element that has a unique property, there's many of them, is iron. Now, the property unique to iron is this, the only element that forms a strong permanent magnetic field. Now, why is that important? Because otherwise, parents, how could you put your kids' homework on the refrigerator? That's really important. No, that's not what it is. It turns out, oh, by the way, another element that's worth mentioning is hydrogen, because hydrogen is the only element that has the ability to produce energy through fusion, through spontaneous fusion. Lucky for us. But to say the least, the source of energy that sustains life, it's really hot over there. You wouldn't want to be there. But it turns out the sun is designed so that almost all the radiation from the sun is visible light, lucky for us, because visible light is the only kind of light that has enough energy to instigate chemical reactions without destroying molecules. But there are two kinds of radiation that come from the sun that would destroy all life. One of them, technically, is not radiation. It's the high-energy ionized particles, that solar wind. And the solar wind would destroy all the life on the Earth, except the Earth is made out of mainly iron. And the magnetic field of the Earth is literally a force field that bends those charged particles around the Earth. Now, here's an interesting coincidence. In fact, I was just telling my physical science students, again, just yesterday in class. Turns out, of all the elements in the periodic table, iron happens to be the most stable element. So why is that important? Well, what's the Earth made out of mostly? Iron. Why? Because it's the most stable element, but it just so happens the most stable element is also the only magnetic element. Otherwise, there'd be no life. And some people think, well, it just sort of happened. Oh, the universe just sort of random. Really? Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Okay, I could talk about the properties of oxygen. Actually, it's interesting. There are two forms of oxygen. One, the normal kind, O2, it's the element without which we cannot have high metabolism, high energy life. The other form of oxygen is ozone. You might be aware of that, O3. And it just so happens there's almost no ozone down in the lower atmosphere. Almost all of it is up in the upper atmosphere. Why is that important? Because ozone absorbs the other kind of high energy radiation that would destroy all life, which is ultraviolet radiation. Many, many more examples. I'll just give one more. Uranium is another element that has a property that no other element has. And that is, it's radioactive with a very, very long half-life. Now you might think, well, that's not so good. Well, actually, it's absolutely essential to life on the Earth. Because uranium, you may be aware, is radioactive. It has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. And the Earth has been around for about 4.5 billion years, so guess what fraction of the uranium is still left around? Half-life of 4.5 billion years. The Earth around 4.5 billion years old? Half of it. It's still giving off heat. Otherwise, the Earth would be cold all the way to the middle. And if the Earth was cold all the way to the middle, you wouldn't have plate tectonics. So why do we need plate tectonics? Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, plate tectonics is like a massive recycling system that recycles the minerals in the Earth. Otherwise, the surface of the continents would be essentially lifeless. Also, if it were not for plate tectonics, we wouldn't have an atmosphere. And it seems like an atmosphere is kind of important stuff there. So if you think, well, you know, I don't really want to live on a planet with plate tectonics or with uranium, awesome. Go to Mars. Almost no uranium. And also a very sterile surface and virtually no atmosphere. Again, and I could have talked about the unique properties of nitrogen, of copper, and many others. But God's fingerprints are all across it. Now, the next one is DNA. Now, when I see the structure of DNA, it kind of, I don't know, it's kind of geeky, but it sort of, you know, makes the hair, it would make the hair on the top of my head stand up, but I don't have any left. So I assume you're generally aware of what DNA is. DNA is this molecule, and this is the most incredible, amazingly designed molecule. It's really pretty spectacular. So it turns out DNA contains these four nucleotides, the G, the C, the A, and the T. And those nucleotides form a code. And three of them are a code that chooses an amino acid in order to build a protein. Let me ask you a simple, common sense question. Could a code be created by molecules simply colliding with one another? Does that make any sense? Could any rational person believe that a code could be created by random events of molecules colliding with each other? I'd say, no, not really. But atheists actually believe it. They actually believe that. It's their only option. Now, it turns out the amount of information we're talking about is quite a bit. The human genome, 3-4 billion base pairs. That's a lot of information. That's the amount of information in a small library. Of course, it's less than the amount of information in your cell phone, but never mind that. All right, anyway, so let's think about it. Let's not talk about the human DNA. Let's talk about, say, the DNA in the simplest life, like a bacteria. 100 million base pairs. Let's cut it in half, 50 million. Cut it in half, 25 million base pairs. 25 million letters. That's a lot of information. Do you know that nature does not ever create information spontaneously? There's no evidence that it does. How much information is that? To use an analogy, it'd be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read them, and they would make sense in the language that you happen to read. Remember, I used the analogy, I said, the cell phone's not a good analogy, it's more like a 747. This is an amount of information that would be contained in 10 books. It'd be like you wrote 10 books, actually more than 10, more like 100 books, and, you know, all randomly throwing letters at the page, and it would be 100 books that you could read that would make sense. And people actually believe that happened by molecules bumping into each other random. Remember the quote was, a series of singularly beneficial accidents. I say, yeah, that's pretty beneficial accidents. You know, and especially here at the university, some people want to give you the feeling that if you're a believer, you must be some kind of like a foolish person, you know. You must lack common sense. I mean, obviously, a scientist would never believe in God. To that I say, really? Whoever came up with that idea? Seriously. I think we as believers are sometimes intimidated by these smart-sounding people. But I think we need to be a little bit maybe more bold. All right, now here's the interesting thing. The only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But guess what the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is? Proteins. So you heard about the chicken and the egg, right? The chicken and the egg, that's nothing. By the way, the egg came first and then the chicken. Just so I'll settle that argument. All right? But anyway, so here's what the atheist believes. And I'm not kidding. They actually believe this. They believe that the protein that would have made the DNA happen just by accident, and at the same time, in the same place, the DNA that would have made the protein that was going to make the DNA also would have happened, and they would, is the right kind of protein, the right kind of DNA, both came together in the same place, and this living thing just starts from there. Okay. Doesn't seem reasonable to me. Now, nature does create order spontaneously. All right, so these crystals happen by a spontaneous process. But what nature never does is create information spontaneously. And any physicist who knows the second law of thermodynamics will tell you that. So let's imagine you're going to build a house of cards. The amount of energy required to build that house would destroy it instantaneously. Could anybody believe that if you threw enough energy at a pile of cards, it would create that? No, that would be irrational. So these are reasons why I came to have a belief in God, even coming from perspective as an atheist, because of studying science. I'm going to skip a few. Oh, let's go to physics. Do a little bit of physics. You guys fans of physics? Yeah. I teach physics. I didn't like learning physics, but I love teaching it. You know, give students all that pain and torture. All right. Anyway. Now, here's what it said in the Bible all along, Hebrews 11:3. By faith we understand that the universe was created so that what is seen has been made from things that are not visible. So the Bible proposed all along that everything that is visible was created from something that is not visible. Now, until the 1940s and 50s, physicists were pretty much unanimous on this. They proposed the universe had existed forever. It's called the steady state theory. Now, why did they propose that? Was that because of the evidence? Well, no. It's because of the philosophical implications of a created universe. Because if you have a created universe, then that kind of implies creator, obviously. All right, so they were very, very confident the universe had existed forever. And then, of course, as you're aware, probably in the late 20s, early 30s, the fact that the universe is rapidly expanding was discovered. And then in the early 60s, they found the background microwave radiation. So now physicists have come around to, in cosmology, to the idea that the universe was indeed created. In fact, here's the model. There was nothing. No matter, no energy, even space, even time. Even time did not exist. And then in one instant, in a brilliant flash of light, the entire universe came to be out of nothing. Sounds like Genesis 1:1 to me. So now physicists have come around to what the Bible said all along, which is, in fact, the universe apparently was created, as they say, ex nihilo. In other words, out of absolutely nothing. But then, in trying to explain the history of this event and trying to come up with a model to explain how this event would have initiated and expanded from there, a physicist discovered something really spectacular, which is the universe is finely tuned to a precision beyond our ability to even understand how precisely tuned it is. There are literally dozens of parameters that define how the universe functions, and with many of them, if you change them the tiniest bit, the whole thing doesn't work. You know, evidence for a fine-tuned universe. Now, would you say that that's a small number? It's 59 zeros and a one. Here's one of the things that cosmologists discovered in looking at the universe. They come up with a model to explain this event they call the Big Bang. Turned out, what they discovered is, if the force of gravity was smaller than it is, by this fraction, the universe would have expanded forever and galaxies and stars would have never formed. On the other hand, if the force of gravity was larger than it is, by this fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it formed, and also a problem for us. So let's just imagine the universe was created at random from nothing. What would be the probability of having the force of gravity having the right value? Well, there it is. Of course, you could ask, why is there gravity in the first place? What's the atheist answer to that? I mean, that's all they can say. Okay? Now, does anybody here play the lotto? Nobody's admitting it. All right, we have somebody who's admitted playing the lotto. Now, let's say that coffee won the big lotto. What would be our response? Yes! Now, what if she won the big lotto again the next week? What if she won the big lottery again the next week? 6 weeks in a row, she wins the big lottery. Where's she going to be? In jail, obviously. All right? The probability of the force of gravity having a value that would work so that we could even exist at all is the equivalent to winning the big lottery six consecutive times. Now, in mathematics, I believe 50 zeros in a one is officially zero. So the probability. So what's the probability that the atheist is right? What's the probability that we just happened that man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents? Based on this one property alone, there you go. You know, as a Christian, I have struggled with my faith at times. But I'm telling you, compared to an atheist, oh my goodness. I mean, the level of faith they have to have in their idea, it's like, it boggles my mind. They actually are able to maintain belief in this? Whoa, I got to have a talk with these people. I know I'm being a little sarcastic there, but you get the idea. Now, there's too much information on this page, but it turns out it's not just the force of gravity, which is finely tuned, but the list goes on and on and on. For example, let's say the nuclear strong force. That's the force that attracts the neutron to the proton. A few percent larger, there'd be no hydrogen. No hydrogen, no stars, no universe, no life. If it was a few percent smaller, there'd be only hydrogen. Also a problem for us. The amount of charge in the universe. Electrons and protons are made through completely different processes. And yet, the balance of those two is something like one part in 10 to the 30th. You change that ratio just the slightest amount, and gravity doesn't control the universe anymore. I could go on and on and on. Too much physics. I'm going to go on to the next thing, okay? Fred Hoyle, a physicist, said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry. And by the way, I haven't talked about biology yet, but I'm not going to because I don't teach biology and I don't know a whole lot of biology. All right? We could talk about the nature of our planet, the nature of our galaxy. There's all kinds of other things. That's good enough for me. So, I say the only rational conclusion of a person who knows science is there has to be a creator. And so I say, do not be intimidated by smart-looking bald men with glasses who tell you if you're a true scientist, you wouldn't believe in God. Seriously. Romans 1:20, God says, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And I would say the person with the least excuse for believing in God would have to be the scientist. To me, that's the way I see it. Now, next I want to talk about science and the Bible. I just want to kind of explain how it works as far as interaction with unbelievers, especially in the university situation. I was at a conference this was a few years ago. It's a bunch of science professors. All we're in a van going between a venue. And so we're in the car. And see, these people, they assume that obviously all scientists don't believe in God. That's kind of the attitude they have. So I was in this van, and this woman says, Christianity, what a stupid religion. And she said, did you know that in the Bible it says, if you wear clothing with two different materials, capital punishment. What kind of stupid religion is that? So I said, excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it in a website. I said, well, you know what? I've read the Bible through, I don't know, at least half a dozen times. I'm telling you right now, it doesn't say that. All right? And then I said, you know, people say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors, and no scientist would ever be a Christian. I said, I've read the Bible many times. I've never found a single science error in there. I don't know what they're talking about. It got really quiet in that van. And then I pulled out my Bible. Whoa. There it goes. And then I pulled out my Bible. I said a quick prayer because I had to find that one in Leviticus, you know? You know the one in Leviticus? Yeah. All I knew is it was on the right-hand side of the page somewhere in Leviticus. Flip, 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 found it, and I read the scripture. Then it got really quiet in that van. But here's my point. See, people tend to say, oh, the Bible, nobody could believe in it, a Q document and all this stuff. And, you know, there's no evidence the Jews were ever in Egypt. And I saw this stuff. All right? But the fact is, generally, these people don't know what they're talking about. Here's a quote from Dallas McCown. He's a well-known atheist, biologist, evolutionist. He says, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. I say, oh, really? Historically fraudulent, okay? So can you tell me a single archaeological find that disproves any claim in the Bible? I don't know of any. I'm going to do a talk for some of the leaders in the local church here tomorrow. I'm going to talk about Christian philosophy, otherwise known as Christian theology, which I believe is vastly superior to postmodernism and modernism and all these other philosophies. But I want to talk about this claim here. Now, the evidence supporting the inspiration of the Bible is, let's say, this big. And the scientific evidence part of that is about this much, okay? I could tell about the evidence for the resurrection, the evidence for miracles and prophets and all those. But tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the evidence from science, specifically for the Bible. Because what we've established so far from the first half of the talk is clearly there's a creator. That creator is very smart and very powerful. All right, we got that down. So, all right, which God then? I would say even based on science alone, the answer is the one who wrote the Bible. So I'm going to talk about why I believe that. This is Papyrus Ebers. It is a medical, it's a compendium of medical knowledge from Egypt, roughly 1500 BC. Now that date's important because that's pretty close to when Moses lived. All right? And people say, oh, the Bible, a book written by a bunch of ignorant people in an ignorant age, just, you know, just their thoughts and their ideas. No wonder it's got so many wrong ideas. Okay, let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. All right, to prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf which has been boiled in oil or with the fat of a rattlesnake. What do you think about that? You've obviously not been using that, sir, but, you know, maybe it's time. All right. Now, don't worry, I'm going to go, I'm going to be the butt of the next joke, so it's all right. A mixture of six fats, namely those of the horse, the hippo, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. All right. Now, I don't know. I assume the purpose of that was so the men would be more attractive to the women, right? Women, would you hang out with a guy who's got this stuff on his head there? I don't know about that. All right. Now, that's funny in a way, but really it's actually not funny at all. Because this was their answer to the problem of health. In ancient times, the average lifespan was around 20 or 25 years. Not that people couldn't live to be 80, 90, or 100, but almost all of them died of an infectious disease. And these are the answers they had. Now, here's my point. If the Bible was what the critics say it was, which is simply human knowledge, just an idea, a story they made up, a fable, then I guarantee you the Bible would have things like this. Because it just so happens, the Bible has actually quite a bit of medical advice. But there's nothing like this in the Bible at all. Not a single example. Here are some of the medicines used in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, pig teeth, rotten meat, moisture from pig's ears. How about human excrement as medicine? You got a little thing there, smear some of that on there, and that'll help that out, okay? Now, here's a verse tucked away in Exodus, Exodus 15:26. God is explaining through Moses to the people why they should be obeying the laws that he gave them. And here's one of the reasons he said they should obey that law. He says, if you obey the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have the diseases of your neighbors. Think about it. How many ancient cultures have a continuous history of 3,500 years? Well, there's the Chinese culture, there's the Indian culture and the Egyptian culture. Oh, and the Jewish culture. They don't seem to fit in that group of having this awesome place to live. And, you know, they're kicked around. Now, I believe one of the reasons the Jews have been around for so long is when they followed the laws that God gave them, they lived longer, they were healthier, they had more children. I'm going to look at just a few examples. So here's one from Leviticus 11. And you're probably aware that the Bible prescribes certain meats okay to eat, certain meats don't eat. Now, it just so happens that every meat on the eat list is relatively safe, and every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. For example, pork. Pork carries at least 22 known diseases, one of them being trichinosis. And it, unless you cook your pork very, very thoroughly, even then, if you have a trusted source, pork can be deadly to eat. All right. But on the other hand, beef, even raw, is relatively safe. I was in Venezuela a few years ago eating at a restaurant. I speak Spanish, but I didn't know what the stuff on the menu was. So I said, just bring me that one, okay? They brought this nice big pile of raw beef. I thought about Leviticus 11. I went for it. It's all right. Now, the Bible says shellfish, lobsters, shrimp, can't eat it. Fish with scales, good to go. And it just so happens that every kind of shellfish and all these things, they all carry multiple diseases. But fish is safe. Fish with scales is safe, even if eaten raw. Now, if this was the only... we're going to look at several examples. If this was the only example of clear medical wisdom in the Old Testament, I suppose the skeptic could say, I don't know, they got lucky, it's just an accident. But the fact is that all other ancient peoples ate these foods and died in droves. But those who obeyed the commandments of God had health. Now maybe you think, well, I don't know, the Jews somehow, they were just better at this. The Jews somehow, I don't know, they just have medical knowledge or something like that. Here's a prescription from a Jewish medical source in ancient times. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Stop right there. According to this statement, flies have no poop. Now, is that true? No, that's a science error. Right there. That's a science error. There is not a single science error in the Bible that I've encountered. I got a PhD in chemical physics. I've read it a few times. If there was one, I think I would have come across it by now. All right, so anyway, here's the prescription. It's a specific against the poison of the viper. So I guess if you got bitten by a snake, you had to keep a jar of flies sort of prepared. Because if you get bitten by a snake, you don't have time to catch flies. So I guess they smeared around there. Help it out. I don't think so. And like I said, if the skeptics of the Bible were correct, there'd be things like this in the Bible, and there simply is not. Here's another one. This is an interesting one. Numbers 19 says, whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the third and the seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent and the furnishings, and the people were there. So here was a law in the Old Testament which says, if anyone touches a dead body, they have to be separate from the people for 7 days. They're unclean. Seems kind of cruel, almost harsh, because that means those who prepare the body can't even attend the funeral. What's that about? What's the purpose of that? Now, this is Ignaz Semmelweis. He was working in a hospital in Vienna in the 1850s. And it was a woman's hospital. In this hospital, the death rate was 18%. That is not very good. In fact, in the 19th century, in the 18th century, the reason women did not have babies in a hospital wasn't because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. Because hospitals were like a very, very dangerous place. Anyway, Semmelweis was working in the hospital. Oh, by the way, I was in Budapest. I was in Budapest. I was talking about Semmelweis, and I said Semmelweis was from Serbia. And they said, no, he's actually from Budapest. I said, well, I heard he's from Serbia. And they took me to his house. So that's me at his house. Anyway, so 18% death rate. Now, in his hospital, what the doctors would do is they've examined the women who died the night before, kind of do an autopsy, and then they proceed up to the medical wards and do their rounds. Wow. So what Semmelweis says, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went down to 4%. Now, the Bible also says when a woman gives birth, she's unclean. And when she has her period, she's unclean. Why would God say that? Because everybody knows that God hates women, you know? Everybody knows that. No, that's not what it is. It's because God loves women. Because when are women extremely susceptible to deadly infections? You can figure that one out for yourself. So Semmelweis says, between every patient, every live patient, you wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went from 18% down to 0.5% by obeying these two, if you will, prescriptions. Now, back then, they didn't know about germs. Actually, during the 19th century is when germs were figured out. Now, one thing to notice is God gives these laws to the people, as I believe he did. He doesn't say why. He just says, do it. And here's the principle. If you don't know why, just do it anyway. You'll have health. For us, spiritual health. For them, physical health. Also, another thing to note is each one of these laws had a spiritual meaning as well as a physical health advantage. That's interesting. All right. Now, another point here is the formula. It was oil of hyssop and ash and water. If you combine the oil of hyssop with ash and water, you make soap. But interestingly, hyssop The oil of hyssop has 10% thymol, this compound here. Now, I teach organic chemistry, and those chemists out there will tell you this is called a phenol, right? It's a phenol.
Right.
Yes, thank you for confirming that. When I teach about phenols, the first property I teach my students about phenols is that they're powerful antiseptics. But interestingly, phenols are not poisonous to us, but they kill bacteria. You know that smell in a hospital? You know what it is? It's thymol. All right? So in other words, God's prescription, if you touch a dead body, is to clean yourself and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. Interesting. All right, here's another one. Skin diseases. Not a very pleasant topic. Leviticus 13:46. God says, whoever has a particular kind of skin infection, which would include leprosy, they remain unclean. They must live alone outside the camp. Complete, utter isolation and separation from the people. Again, seems quite harsh. All right, but it turns out that leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. Didn't kill the most people. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. Diphtheria killed more people. Yellow fever killed more people. But the way leprosy kills is truly horrifying. I'll skip that slide. Thank you very much. Medical doctors had no explanation. They said it's the alignment of the planets. They said if you eat hot food, it'll prevent it. Well, if that's true, then people in India and Thailand would not have leprosy, so I don't think that's right. Now, it turns out in the 16th century, there were some monks in Sweden who were reading the Old Testament. They saw this advice to have complete quarantine, and they thought, let's try it. Let's completely quarantine anybody who has leprosy. And within two or three generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe. Simply following a simple biblical advice. By the way, a leprosy is caused by bacteria. Now all you need is a few dollars worth of antibiotics to cure leprosy. All right, here's another one. Leviticus 17:14. The life of every creature is in its blood. That is why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Again, it seems like a kind of a bizarre commandment here. The life of every creature is in its blood. And like I said, I see health implications here, but I see a spiritual significance to this statement. The life of every creature is in the blood. All right, now, do you know what the most common medical treatment in Europe was for infectious diseases in the 19th century? Bloodletting. Because the accepted dogma of medical science was, if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. Which makes sense. That would explain how it gets around the body. So what they would do is, if somebody has an infectious disease, they'd cut them open and drain out a couple of pints of blood, try to help get rid of that infection. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Well, who was right on that one? Well, you and I both know that if you have an infection, the worst thing you could do is drain out your immune system through taking out the blood. Hey, last example. There are others, but this is good enough. I think you get the idea. You came in just in time for my last example. You just have to imagine the rest. All right. So, what about circumcision? Now, interestingly, circumcision is before Moses. Circumcision goes back to the time of Abraham. And if the Bible is inspired by God, and I believe it is, we have here the words of God to Abraham. He said, for the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Ouch! That's painful! So here's my question. Why circumcision? Number one. And then, why on the eighth day? Now, we could talk about the spiritual meaning of circumcision and you know, Colossians 2, it's the cutting off of sin is symbolic of that. But let's talk about the health benefit. Now, let's think about it. Almost everyone died of an infectious disease of one sort or another back then. usually yeast or bacteria. And both yeast and bacteria thrive wherever it's warm and dark and wet. So what's the warmest, darkest, wettest place on a guy? All right, well, you know, I think you can figure that one out, okay? How many Jewish lives were saved by this simple act? And whose lives were being saved? Primarily women's lives. Did you know that the spread of AIDS from male to female is reduced by at least 60%? Multiple studies have shown through male circumcision. So that in Africa, they're starting circumcision programs for adult males. You know what would be a better idea? To obey the Bible's command about having sex only with your wife. How about that one? I think that would solve not the whole problem. I don't mean to minimize it, by the way. I don't mean to minimize it at all. But I think that would probably be the best way to deal with that issue. So why on the eighth day, though? So I think I see why circumcision. Why on the eighth day? Well, I think I know. I'm not sure, but I think I know. Now, here's a fact about newborns. See, it turns out vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. So when a child is born, they have no vitamin K, zero. So if you were to perform a circumcision on the day of birth, that would be really, really bad. Because they had a very high chance of bleeding to death. Now, it turns out the vitamin K is not what causes the blood clot. What actually causes the blood clot is prothrombin, which is a protein that's created by vitamin K. And there is a small amount of prothrombin in an infant, but much lower than the level that we have. And what happens is the baby eats from the mommy and gets bacteria. Those bacteria end up in the intestines, and they start producing vitamin K the third, fourth day. And so what happens is the prothrombin level goes up to an unnaturally high level, and then it drops back down to the normal level. So I'm going to show you a graph of level of prothrombin in the male child versus time since they were born. And by the way, just, you know, my daughter's, you know, she's this, you know, we're hoping we're going to see a birth going on. And her due date is today. So that's pretty cool. So this is extra special to me. But anyway, that's just, you know, that's what happens. When you become a grandparent, you put the picture up there and all that kind of stuff. So I can't help it. So here we go. Level of prothrombin in the child versus time. Guess what? The safest day, from the day that child is born till the day that child dies, guess what the safest day to do a circumcision is? The seventh, eighth, ninth day, somewhere around there. Now you could say, well, you know, just got lucky. Or maybe what Abraham did was he did a double-blind experiment in which, so we're going to, you know, for the next 10 years, we're going to circumcise on the first day, and we're going to graph it all out. Now, I think a more reasonable explanation is that the Bible's inspired by God. So like I said, don't be intimidated by smart-sounding people who tell you belief in God is foolish. Because I believe lack of belief in God, it borders on irrational. And more specifically, I would say, belief in the God of the Bible. And I've just looked at a few facts from science, but I'd say the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible is much, much bigger than that. But I'm going to stop there. We're going to take some questions from the audience. Any question you want, it could be related directly to the topic or another biblical topic or... Yes? Yeah.
And I was wondering as for like how humans were created, what about like evolution and like
yeah.
For example, if you had a code that you had to figure out and you had there was a bunch of it, you know, eventually if you had hundreds of years you could solve it. So I'm just curious
about that. Yeah, first of all, the Bible gives credit to the creator of the universe, also to creating life. And I believe that life could not have been created by some sort of random set of events. But the Bible also gives God credit for creating all the species. But it doesn't say how he did it. And I believe that in questions of this sort, we should simply ask by looking at nature. Nature speaks for herself. And apparently what God created was evolution. And some believers are sort of, I guess, defensive about evolution, as if they should be. I mean, why should they be? I mean, since God invented evolution, I'd say, thank you, God, for that great idea. It turns out, once you have existing information and what we call an energy-fixing mechanism in a memory-maintaining system called life, that life is able to change through a process of evolution. And evolution was a great plan, because what happens is the environment changes and living things have to change in response to that. In fact, mutations are natural. In fact, there's a small level of background radiation without which we'd have less mutations. But without mutations, you don't have evolution. So I believe that God did create many, many different species through a process of evolution. Now, that doesn't mean God did not intervene in that process. I really don't know. I mean, there's evidence from the Cambrian explosion 540 million years ago. All five phyla appear in the fossil record simultaneously with no obvious prior animal phyla. To me, there's evidence of God having intervened in that process. I don't believe it's fully random. But anyway, God creates natural processes. God creates natural processes by which stars form, by which planets form, by which those planets have water on them. So God uses natural processes, and yet I believe he intervenes, for example, to create life itself. So I, as a Christian, I have no problem with the idea of evolution. In fact, there's plenty of evidence for it. I would suggest reading a book called The Language of God by Francis Collins. He's the head of the National Institutes of Health and a believer. And he a friend of mine at Point Loma Nazarene, Daryl Falk, who wrote the book Coming to Peace with Science. And so those would be books that could be helpful for you to kind of get a perspective on a Christian view of evolution. So anyway, I understand that some Christians are fairly, you know, they say that that evolution is some plan of Satan or something like that. Really? I say it's God's plan. So why not give him credit for it? Okay? That there's more to that question, but I'll leave it at that for now. It was a question of the age of the earth, but yes. So, a couple of questions there. So, are you asking where did Adam and Eve come from, or are you asking how did we come from Adam and Eve? Which is your question?
What about the second part?
All right. Now, first of all, let me tell you, a lot of believers get in trouble because they don't do a very good job of separating what they believe by faith from what they believe because of the evidence. So, let me explain. For example, I believe that God created the universe because the evidence forces me to that conclusion. Who's asking this question? I want to look at the person. You know.
I can't see you. I don't have my glasses.
Yeah. All right. So I believe the universe was created by God because of the evidence. I believe life was created by God because of the evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. I believe that the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence. I believe in heaven by faith. I have absolutely no evidence for that. I believe in Adam and Eve because they're in the Bible. I'll just tell you that right now. I'm not going to pretend that I have evidence. In fact, what evidence would you look for? Adam and Eve slept here? I mean, what would you really look for? So I'm going to confess to you, I believe in a sort of a creation of this first humans that in God's image. I believe in that because it's in the Bible. So you're asking, how did we get here from there? Well, I mean, I can't trace the full genealogy, but I would say this, mutations clearly occurred. We have people with lighter skin, darker skin, taller, shorter, curly hair, straight hair. These kind of mutations, not only are they natural, they're actually essential for humans to be able to adapt and change over time. The fact is, humans are very, very close to one another genetically. For example, dogs. Dogs have a vastly wider gene pool than we do as human beings. The evidence is, from science, is that there was a bottleneck maybe 20 or 30,000 years ago. In other words, a point where the human population got down to almost nothing. Like maybe two, possibly. Now, I'm not saying belief in Adam and Eve is scientific per se. In fact, the evidence that humans are related genetically to the great apes is quite large. Like I tell my students, as an example of this, let me tell you all the mammals who do not produce vitamin C. All the mammals who do not produce vitamin C are humans, chimps, orangutans, bonobos, chimpanzees, gorillas, and guinea pigs. Isn't that interesting? Now, it turns out the mutation that causes guinea pigs to not produce vitamin C is different from the mutation that causes the great apes to not produce vitamin C. So the scientific proposal that there's a common ancestor for humans is not a ridiculous proposal. I'm just going to put it right out there. In fact, people will say, oh, that's ridiculous. No, it's not ridiculous. Now, I believe that the amount of change that has occurred cannot be explained simply by random events. I believe that God intervened. Okay? Not sure if I answered every aspect of that question, but at least I got started. All right, other questions? Yes? All right. All right. All right. So she's asking, how can you, as a scientist, explain the resurrection? The answer is, I can't. That's the whole point. All right. I believe that was a supernatural event. And a supernatural event, by definition, is an event that defies the laws of nature. It's a miracle. Now, I've heard people say stuff like this, and this is nonsense. This is utter nonsense. But I hear people saying things like, science proves that there are no miracles. That's nonsense. That doesn't even make sense. Because science deals with the things that are natural. By definition, science describes the things that are natural. It does something whose entire job is to explain that things are natural, prove that everything is natural. How could it? So I believe the resurrection of Jesus is a miracle. It's a clear evidence of a miracle. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is not scientific. Really, all science can really do, just in the topic of miracles, all science can really do is say, now if that happened, that would be a miracle. So science can help us define what would be a miracle, but science is completely unable to even address the question of whether miracles happen. Let me explain an example of how scientists tend to use this circular reasoning. I was watching a BBC show a few years ago. It was kind of like they had a panel, and then they brought in these intellectuals, and it's like intellectuals on trial. So in this particular show, they had a believer and a non-believer, and the atheist guy, he's a chemist, he comes up there and they ask him to give his opening statement. He says, it is a fact, the only things that are real are things that can be measured and through science. And they said, excuse me, all right, fine, well, how do you know that? What's your evidence for that? He said, well, you know, all these Muslims and these Christians and blah, 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 and the Crusades. And they said, excuse me, we asked you a question. You told us the only things that are real are physical things that can be measured. This is the materialist idea. He said, oh, blah, 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 and the Bible this, and blah, blah, blah. And they said, sir, we asked you a question. If you're not going to answer the question, we'll just bring up the next speaker. He says, well, I guess I just believe it. His entire belief system was, well, I guess I just believe it. All right, that kind of reveals the thinking there. So, to me, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead is a miracle, clearly. And it's evidence of God. It's not the only evidence. In fact, arguably, it's not the strongest evidence because there's a couple of lines of reasoning there. Even David Hume said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And the resurrection is clearly an extraordinary claim. But I believe there's extraordinary proof. There's the empty tomb. There's the fact of the crucifixion. All right? And there's the fact of open proclamation of the resurrection in Jerusalem at that time. So I believe the evidence leads to the only possible conclusion, which is that Jesus was raised from the dead. But science doesn't help you there other than to say, now that was a miracle. All right? Other questions? Yep. A reason about what?
What those people did.
All right, so you're asking how did people have a relationship with God, let's say 4,000 BC or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, the biblical record, if you will, is this is what's known as the patriarchal period, where God was having a relationship with people through heads of households, essentially. For example, Job had nothing like the Bible. Job was not even a Jew. Abraham was not a Jew. And there were clearly people believing in the one God in ancient times. I believe God holds us responsible for what he gives us and not for what he doesn't give us or what we don't know. So I'm going to settle for giving you a relatively vague answer. Because I'm not the judge, God is. But I believe that all of us will be judged according to what we know. In fact, Romans chapter 1 near the end suggests that idea. It talks about people being judged according to their conscience and what they know. However, for me personally, on Judgment Day, if I come before God, I personally would not want to say, hey, here's what I did. You know, I'm pretty much good to go. We're good, you know. So I'm just going to leave that for God to be the judge. I'm not the judge. So, but what I can say is there is evidence, at least in the Bible, that outside of the Bible, there were people that were believing in the God, the same God that we believe in. Did they have a concept of salvation? No. So I just have to trust in God. But that God exists is obvious. That's what it says in Romans 1. I agree with that. Now, were the majority of people just pagans and you know, having, you know, gross beliefs and gross activities? Yes. Kind of like today. All right. But I'm sorry, but I have to give you a somewhat vague answer to that. But there's biblical evidence of belief in the one God of people other than the Jews. Melchizedek would be one. Melchizedek was a priest of Jehovah who was not Jewish and had a belief in the same God. Yes. I'm. Could you speak a little louder?
Okay. So I said, assuming any time, like you know, during your career years, that you learn something, and then you have to be able to repeat this and that, and how do you repeat
it? So you're asking, have I ever had doubts and things that came up that really shook my faith a little bit? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, sure. Of course. Anybody who doesn't have doubts, I worry about that person. Oh my goodness gracious. I mean, doubts are essential to faith. I'm serious about that. Doubts are essential to faith. Do I ever find myself wondering, when I die, am I really gonna, you know, yes. I wonder about that. You know, heaven, I don't understand heaven. Heaven doesn't really make a lot of sense to me because to me, in this life, without suffering, there's no joy. And so I don't, you know, and besides, one of the greatest things we have is freedom of choice, free will. So do we even have free will? There's all kinds of questions I have about that. The things that give me struggle are more theological questions than questions about the believability of the Bible. Because fairly early on, I was looking at the prophecies about the Messiah. To me, it's sort of like what's the most reasonable conclusion? Now, I'm a scientist. I tend to think a little bit analytically. Not all right. A lot analytically. All right, so to me, I ask, what's the most reasonable conclusion? So in science, if we have a counter example, that doesn't create a problem for us. We just keep looking, but we stick with the most reasonable explanation. So for me, very early on in Christianity, looking at fulfillment of prophecy, at evidence for miracles of Jesus, evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, the big picture was solved for me personally very early in my Christian walk. You know, like within just a few months of when I was a Christian. So I began to give the benefit of the doubt to the Bible. And what I've found is, when I give the benefit of the doubt to the Bible, it always turns out to be right. Just to give an example. My wife has been faithful to me for 32 years. And you know what? I don't really worry about if she's looking at other guys. I don't even think about it anymore. In fact, let's say I heard she had lunch with some guy. I would say, I'm sure there's a reason. I mean, I wouldn't even think about it because the question's pretty much settled. That doesn't mean that when it comes to the Bible, I don't keep asking questions. Absolutely, I keep asking questions. If you go to my website, you'll see over 2,000 questions that I've answered. People say there's lots of contradictions in the Bible. I find 98% of their claims is like, come on, give me a break. But, you know, there's still one that I'm working on. There's the one where it says, Jesus says, in one gospel he says, take a staff. In another gospel he says, don't take a staff. You know what? That's the only contradiction in the Bible I've ever found myself thinking, yeah, how's that one work? You know what I'm saying? So, let me give you a suggestion. If anybody feels guilt for having doubt, just get rid of that idea. That's crazy. But I say, if you have questions, write them down. Literally write them down. And at first, it might be a little bit scary. The list might get kind of long. You might almost find yourself talking yourself out of your faith. All right, but I say, you know, keep asking questions. And eventually, you start getting all these check marks. And 2 or 3 years down the road, you'll have, 147 check marks and 3 unanswered questions or 5 unanswered questions. At some point, common sense says, you know what? It's kind of like me trusting my wife. I don't really have a problem with that. All right? So what I've found is this. When you listen to what the skeptics say, it always increases my faith. Always. They say, oh, yeah, this, that, and the other thing. I investigate, and I find myself going, they actually believe that? I mean, seriously? So I've never found it to cause a problem. But everybody's different. So I think the approach would, for everybody, be a little bit different. So that's how it works for me. All right. A couple more questions. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about that. She's asking, for example, I gave examples of things. If you change them ever so slightly, everything sort of falls apart. I would say this. According to Maxwell's equation, the speed of light is determined by 2 things, which is the electrical permittivity and the magnetic permittivity of free space. You multiply those 2, take the square root, you get the value c. Now, both of those numbers are fantastically well precise. I don't really have a good answer to your question. I've never really thought about that. I would say this. If you study relativity, the speed of light is the only absolute thing in the universe. All other things are relative. So time is relative. Mass is relative. Everything is relative. The only thing that's absolute is light itself, the speed of light. And so when I read in Genesis 1, God said, let there be light, and there was light, that's kind of like, that's really cool to me. But, in order to change the speed of light, you'd have to change these 2 other constants, both of which are very precisely tuned to allow for life to exist. So I don't know. That's not a very good answer. That's the best I could do, though. All right, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Go ahead.
So speaking of Genesis 1, it talks about the creation of everything.
Yeah.
And then goes straight into Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
But now, these days, you know, we find evidence of prehistoric creatures.
Yeah.
And history.
So we're talking about the age of the earth, that whole question. All right, great.
Yeah, so like, in other words, like, do you think there's a spiritual reason for, you know,
prehistoric creatures? A spiritual reason? I don't know. First of all, the Bible is not a science book, and the intention of Genesis 1 is not to give us a scientific treatise. The way Galileo put it, he said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I think there's wisdom there. The Bible is a God book. It's not a science book. So, for example, when God's explaining his creation, he's not using scientific precision. He's using theological precision in Genesis 1. For example, he says, in the beginning. Well, that means there was a beginning. And science confirms that. Then it says, in the beginning, God, which means the God of the universe pre-exists creation, which means the pantheistic Indian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy is out. And there's a lot of theological precision there. But as for the timing, I believe that he's saying, first this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And he uses the day motif. I suppose he could have said, you know, 3 billion years and then 1.7 billion years, but God didn't choose to do that. So he's not using scientific precision. He's using theological precision in Genesis. So I believe those, in quotes, days of Genesis represent the periods of time over which God did what he did. And it just so happens the details fit pretty well. So first God says, let there be light. All right, that sounds about right. And then the earth is in existence, and the earth is covered with water. And then eventually land emerges from water, which scientists would agree that's what happened. And then it shows life appearing in the water first. Scientists would agree that's what happened. Then it shows the stars and the sun and the moon appearing on the fourth day. Why? Because scientists would tell us the early life massively changed the atmosphere of the earth. So instead of being methane and ammonia, now it's primarily things like nitrogen and oxygen. And then the heavenly objects became visible. And then life appears on the land. And last of all, human beings come. So in a broad outline, Genesis 1 is a beautiful picture of what actually happened. By the way, you should know that Jewish theologians such as Philo in the first century believed that these days were metaphorical. Basically, first God did this, then did this, then did this. So I believe as an outline form, what's described in Genesis 1 fits perfectly with science. Now, it's another thing you could do, you can get a copy of my book back there, Is There a God? What I do is I describe some of the other creation myths. By the way, I believe the Bible has myths. All right? It just happens to have a true myth. What I mean by that is all ancient peoples had a creation myth. And what is a myth? A myth is a simplified story to explain, you know, kind of what happened. But the difference is you could read the Iroquois myth and the Babylonian myth and the Greek myth and the Norse myth. And they have sort of bizarre things, this thing, this God's battling this, and the blood comes down, and the, you know, all this other crazy stuff. Then you have the Bible with a very, very simple story, which just so happens, then I have all these goofy, weird battles going on, and it just so happens to agree with what I know from science. Now, I know there are a lot of people who believe the earth is young, and they take Genesis 1 literally. I don't have a problem with that personally. I mean, you know, to me it doesn't matter that much. But I think they're probably wrong. I'm pretty confident they're wrong. But, you know, by the way, I teach a philosophy of science class, and I deal with this question because I have a lot of young earthers in my classes, and I want to show respect to them. So here's what I do. I literally say, I want to talk about the young earth idea. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk over there, and I'm going to pretend I'm a theologian instead of a scientist. So I literally do that. And I say, all right, so now speaking theologically, let me take as a premise that there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-omni-this, omni-that creator as a premise. On that premise, could that God create an earth appearing to be old when he created it? And even the atheist in my class said, well, yeah, I suppose he could. All right, well, all right, then the only question is whether he did or not. Then I go back and I argue with myself. I walk over here. And I say, well, wait a minute. Let's say we're looking at a galaxy a billion light years away from here through a telescope. The light that's hitting my eye, presumably, when did it leave that galaxy? If it's 1 billion light years away. 1 billion years ago. So if that galaxy is only a few thousand years old, then why is the light here? All right. The God I believed in made fish that was ready to eat. And the prophet John said that God could create children of Abraham out of the stones, and I believe it. God could do whatever he wants. And then, you know what? Doesn't matter to me very much. All right, but I personally believe the universe is quite old. The evidence is strong for that. I'm sticking with that, but I don't really worry about it too much. All right, that was a long answer, and I only want to go about 3 or 4 more minutes, so up here, and if we're lucky, down there. Yeah. No, certain scientists make that assumption. I'm not one of them, that's for sure.
So I was going to say, do you think there are any limitations in using science to validate the Bible?
All right. First of all, science doesn't prove the Bible. Not at all. I would just say that what I know from science supports my belief in the Bible. That's as far as I would go. History doesn't prove the Bible. But what I know from history supports the Bible. Psychology doesn't prove the Bible. But what I know from psychology supports the Bible. All right, and so, you know, it's not like you have some mathematical equation at the end equals God. It doesn't work that way. And I believe God gave us choice. God gave us free will. God doesn't drop notes out of the sky. He doesn't force anybody to believe. I believe God leaves room for doubt out of respect for us. But to me, I just find, not only do I find no conflict between my knowledge of science and Christianity, I find them to work together, not against each other. I wrote an article in a textbook that I have done where I talk about that. All right? So, you know, science does not prove Christianity per se, but I believe that it supports belief in Christianity. All right.
My question is how to dialogue with unbelief the scientists, and which books you write is fit them to read.
Yeah. So her question is, how can you talk about the Bible with somebody who doesn't believe in God or any authority at all? That's a really good question. I would say I would start with a worldview kind of discussion. So, you know, pulling out the Bible, and saying, it says right here, all Scripture is inspired by God. So you need to believe that. To an unbeliever, that's crazy. You're talking like pixie dust and fairy tales. So I think having a worldview discussion, which, by the way, I'm going to be talking about tomorrow in the class that I'm going to be doing. But anyway, how about this? Could you send me the card back there? Send me a question. I'll send you to an article that I've written on the Christian worldview. So I would talk about, basically, there's the postmodern worldview, there's the pantheistic worldview, there's the atheist worldview, you know, there's the Muslim worldview, and there's all these different worldviews. And ask a few questions. First of all, is it true? By that, what I mean is it consistent with what we know? Number two, does it answer the questions we care about in a satisfactory way? And number three, does it make us a better person than we otherwise would have been? And on all three counts, atheism completely, utterly fails compared to Christianity. All right, for example, atheism can't explain some of those basic facts, such as that we exist. You know, I would say in any group of people, ask a simple question. Do we have a body or are we a body? Everybody knows the answer, except the scientists. And the atheists, their answers, they don't answer the most basic questions. Like, is it wrong to murder? They provide very senseless answers to these things. So I would try to go for a worldview discussion. So what's the basic view of the universe that you have? And is that consistent with what we know? Does it answer the questions that people care about? And can we reasonably conclude that those who take this worldview would be better than they otherwise would be? And I believe Christianity is better than the Muslim worldview, the Buddhist worldview, the Hindu worldview, the atheist. And I'd happily send you to that essay to kind of get started. There's a book called The Universe Next Door. It's a very book about that thick on Christian worldview. I think it'd be useful. There's a lot of stuff out there. All right, it's 10:15. I think it's time to figure out who's going to win this awesome prize.
Still to give out. So we've got three left, and I'm going to just drop random.